We're going to go ahead and get started. We couldn't get our pictures to work, so I'm really sorry. We had images for this, and really looking forward to the...
Not a porn.
Not a porn, obviously.
You need to be clear about
that. Strap in for that. We have two sessions of that for you. We thank you for being here for this. This is something that Chris and I enjoy talking about, helping people through, something we have experience with personally, and as a result of that, have made it part of our ministry to help others to be equipped to deal with the problem, to know what the problem is and understand how it works, and to know that if you are involved in the problem as well, that's okay. There's a way out of that. And so we're going to start today. Chris is going to start us off. We're going to talk about our personal experiences with this a little bit, and then move on to talking about the actual facets of the problem.
Yeah. So my name is Chris Croats, and before I get started with my story, just be aware up front that this is a class about pornography. And so if that word sounds like, you know, nails on a chalkboard to you, get used to it. I believe that that's part of the problem that we have in our churches today, is that we are uncomfortable with the topic of sex and pornography, and this problem is only getting worse because of that. So unless we can actually address the problem and talk about it in a grown-up way, it's only going to get worse. So my story starts out like this. I was first exposed to pornography around the age of 10. I was invited over to my neighbor's garage, and her dad was like this big, burly mechanic type. He had this huge garage where he worked on Mustangs and motorcycles, and I thought that was cool, and so I was taking a trip around the garage, and she said, "Hey, come back to this room back here." And what this guy had done is basically he had used Playboy centerfolds as wallpaper in his back room. Growing up, as I didn't grow up in the church, I was a heathen child, and so I thought that, wow, this is kind of cool. You know, I've never seen this before. This is interesting, and so that kind of sparked my interest in it right away. We flash forward about a year later, and I was actually in my neighborhood. There was an older boy who started to sexually abuse me. Luckily, that relationship only lasted for a very short amount of time, but the damage was done. And so what I spent the rest of my early teen years doing was typically when you are abused, especially sexual abuse, you either go one of two ways. Either you really latch onto that as your identity, or you try to go as far away from that as you possibly can, and you overcompensate. And so that was me. I was the guy in the locker room who always made light of and was talking about watching pornography and masturbation and all of these things, because I wanted, even though nobody knew this, I wanted everyone to know that that's my abuse wasn't who I am. And so I was the overly sexual teenager. We flash forward a few more years. At the age of 16, I became a Christian. And I remember having this conversation. I went to a camp in Nebraska, and we didn't have a pool. We got baptized in the lake. And the first thing you do when you get baptized is you go take a shower, because you smell like the lake. And I remember taking my shower after I was baptized, having this conversation with God that, you know, no more girls, and especially I'm done with this pornography thing. No more, because not only did I knew before that it was bad, but now I knew that this is sinful and that this is harming my relationship with God, and this is very important to me now. Swearing off women lasted about 2 months, because then my future wife moved to town, and she was the preacher's daughter, and I saw her on a Wednesday night after I got back from camp sitting in the preacher's office, and it was like, game on. All right. And the rest is history. But after that, you know, we dated throughout high school for the rest of high school, and then we got married, and I foolishly thought, even though, you know, I knew that this was bad for my relationship with God, it's not what I should be doing, I was stuck in this cycle. you know, I'd go to camp, I would be on a spiritual high for a week or two, be really good, and then I would fail. I would go to a youth rally, might be good for a week or maybe a couple days, might hear a really good sermon on a Sunday and dedicate my life back to God, but I never did anything about it. My wife and I got married a year after high school, and I told her before we got married that, hey, this is an issue for me, and I struggle in this way, but I don't think her or I really knew what that meant, because deep down in my mind, in my heart, I thought, well, once I get married, then this won't be an issue anymore, because, you know, married people, they have sex all the time, and, you know, I won't have to look at pornography anymore. That lasted for about 6 months into our marriage before I was right back to where I started. My wife found out. Of course, I was very, you know, disgusted with myself. I couldn't believe that I let this happen again. And I told her, it's done. It's over with. This will never happen again. But I didn't do anything about it. And again, 6 months later, we had... we welcomed our first child together, and at that point, I looked at my life and said, I can't be doing, Chris, you can't be doing this stuff anymore. You're about to have a daughter yourself. What are you doing? Didn't do anything about it. So that lasted maybe a month, another kid, and another kid. We have four kids, so like this cycle happened over and over and over again. Tried to convince myself that I could handle it by myself. Didn't do anything about it. And it, surprise, surprise, I was stuck in this cycle, stuck in this loop of trying to get better, not really doing anything about it, just to find myself back. About when, right as our fourth child was born, we decided that we wanted to go into ministry. And so we went to Bear Valley. And I thought, again, foolishly to myself, that this wasn't the reason why I went to preaching school, but I thought, what a fantastic benefit of going to school is that this will take care of my porn problem. You know, I'll be in school 8 hours a day studying scripture, and when I'm not in school, I'm going to be around some of the best influences that I could be around. We're going to be, you know, encouraging each other, fellowshipping. It turns out, for those of you who've been to preaching school is a very high stress environment. And if anything, it only made the addiction worse. Because now I know now that stress is one of my triggers. That when I get stressed out, I want to de-stress or to cope with that stress by looking at pornography. And so there I was, 6 months from graduation. I had my first job lined out. I was going to be a youth and family minister in Ohio. And, you know, completely lost. I didn't know what I was doing or what I was going to do about this problem, because I knew it was a problem. And I honestly thought to myself that God must have a special place in hell for people like me. People that claim to have it all figured out. I was supposed to be the one with all of the answers, and yet I was just as lost as anyone else could possibly be. And so I was walking through Mardell's one day in Denver. And I saw a book that I hadn't read. Up to that point, I'd read a bunch of books on pornography. And I saw a new one I hadn't read before, and I thought, what could it hurt? And so I read it, and it outlined a different type of accountability. And I thought to myself, all right, you know, let's give this a shot. And so I bought two more copies of the book, and I mailed it to two of my best friends. One was this guy. Another guy that I also knew had probably struggled with the problem. And then we read it. And we said, let's do this. And that was the beginning of Overcome. But before we get too far, Jack has his story.
That book is where Chris and I overlap and where all this came from, and us ultimately dealing with the issue in a real way. I was shown pornography. It was third grade. I'm not sure how old that would make me, but it was third grade, and somebody at recess had cut out a picture from his dad's book and brought it and shown that to several of us. That didn't turn into anything, right? But it was there now. And I remember fifth grade, sleepover at a friend's house for birthday party. Kids from school. Bunch of us guys from school. And they had HBO and Cinemax and all these things. And we stayed up late, and that was just on. And I remember that very vividly. And having that there laid the groundwork for when my parents got divorced in middle school, I didn't know how to deal with it. And so that's how I dealt with it. I had a place to go, to feel better, to run away, and that's where my problem came in. And started to, like Chris described, very much the same way, go and watch it, feel better, feel horrible, and keep going. Thinking that, all right, well, I know that I grew up in the church, so not a heathen like Chris. but I knew better. And so I kept telling myself, well, I've got to stop now. It's going to be better. I'm going to be around these people. I'm going to be involved in these events. And then it didn't get better. Well, I'm going to preaching school. I know what I want to do with my life. It doesn't get better. I'm at preaching school. And I'm making a focused attempt to crack down on it harder. But there's still this, well, I messed up again. And then a friend gives me a book, and here we are now. And that's the sharing of these stories. How many times have you done that? 20, 30, 50 times? I've shared it quite a few times as well, and we've written about it and talked about it. And the large part of that is what we're going to talk about in the second session after lunch, of why, how you fix the problem comes down to this accountability, which starts with vulnerability. And if we're going to encourage you to do that, we want to be the examples of that. That many people struggle with this, and we're no different. But you can get out of it. And we're hopefully good examples of that. But the reason why the struggle exists, as we're going to talk about now for the rest of the time, there's this perfect storm scenario that we're in right now. And technology is going to continue to make this worse as the years go on.
The perfect storm, as Jack alluded to, is what I call a combination of what we have today is a combination of technology, a dependence on technology, and impatience. I have a couple of stats for us here. There was a Harvard study done just last year that showed that us people living in the United States, we spend 2 to 4 hours a day tapping, typing, or swiping on our phones. 2 to 4 hours a day. That's 2,600 daily touches, okay, on our cell phones. Do we have a problem? Maybe. Maybe, absolutely. But the real issue comes in, and we're going to talk about, I'm going to name a drug here, but we're going to talk about it more in depth later. But just know that cell phone use, using apps, causes a release of dopamine in our brains. Dopamine is tied to the reward centers that says, ooh, that was good, let's do that again. And again, like I said, we're going to talk more about that later. The VP for user growth at Facebook said this. He says, I feel tremendous guilt for the short-term dopamine-driven feedback loops that we have created that are now destroying how society works. If you don't think that these companies, social media, apps, cell phone makers don't know how our brain works, you are fooling yourself. Because the way that people develop apps, and there are studies done on this, is the same, they're using the same feedback loops that gambling addicts use at the slot machine. They know just how much reward to give and how much not to give to keep someone hooked on an app or social media, because all of that causes a dopamine release. Dopamine can be highly addictive. It involves things like alcohol, drugs, gambling. And for us today, in large part, there is no age requirement for social media. Granted, you know, you have to click the box that says, yes, I'm 13 years or older. But if you ask most 12, 11-year-olds, they don't read that. Or if they do, they're fine with lying about it anyways. And so we have these very young people who are getting addicted to social media and cell phone use. If you relate this to like alcoholism, let's say, that's a lot of studies have been put out about that because it's been around for a lot longer than cell phone use and apps. But much of that addiction works the same way. And that is that most every alcoholic discovered alcohol during their teen years. And as they teenagers, for those of you who have teenagers or had teenagers, it is a stressful time. both for the teen and the parent. I have a 16-year-old and a 13-year-old now. And it's weird. It's a weird spot to be in because you're trying to teach them to be, you know, self-reliant. They're supposed to be relying more on their peers, but that stresses parents out a lot. And I get it now. I didn't know what I was getting into, but I get it now of how stressful that can be. They're supposed to rely on their friends, and that's a good thing. That's what we should want our kids to do as they grow up into full-fledged adults, that they should rely on their friends. But what we're finding and what the alcoholic does is that instead of relying on their friends, they rely on the bottle. And it's very much the same for social media and cell phone use, is that instead of what this young generation, the generation, if you were here for Brandon's talk yesterday, he was talking about how this new generation that's coming up after the millennials, they have never known a world without the internet. They don't know what that's like. And so they are growing up in this world where they are dependent on the internet, on social media. And because of that, if you look at, you know, like I look at my kids and how they interact with their friends, and I think that it's weird that they communicate by sending, you know, their face with, you know, cat ears on it to each other, and that's like hello instead of what we would do is just go up to each other and say hello. That's what they do, and it's funny to look at that. But we need to understand that there is a true cost with that as well, that communication is breaking down, relationships are breaking down. We translate all of this to technology and social media. We find that young people are unable to develop deep, meaningful relationships. They would admit that friendships are very superficial, that they do not rely on their friends, and they don't have the skill set to have the right coping mechanism. So needless to all that to say, we have a dependence on technology. And good, bad, or indifferent, that is the reality that we are living in today. That young people, and for the most part, all of us, we have a dependence on technology, and we're also impatient, right? We are a very impatient people, especially us living in this country. We've been spoiled by two-day shipping from Amazon for so long that we can't imagine a life without it, right? Even when two-day shipping turns into three-day shipping, we're raging, right? Like, what? Can you believe? Of course, 10 years ago, we'd say you could have anything in 2 days. We would think that's incredible. That's crazy. But today, we're like, no. Amazon's coming out with one-day shipping, or in some locations, same-day shipping, right? It's getting faster and faster and faster, and that, too, has a cost. And when we look at this perfect storm of dependence on technology and the fact that we are an extremely impatient society as a whole, that's all you need for a perfect storm for an entire culture, an entire generation of pornography addiction.
Statistically, here's what that looks like, and I wish these could be on the screen, so I'll try to lay these out in a way that we can hear them, because there's several that we want to talk about here. 93% of boys are exposed to porn before age 18. That's 93%, and 62% of girls. And that's a study from 2008. That's not going down, by the way. That is going to continue to go up, and we'll talk about the reasons for that. But that's before 18. When Chris and I shared our stories about that, we're both in elementary school. Yeah. I didn't mention this in my story either. There was a kid down the street invited me over, and he found a picture somewhere, and he had that stored away in one of his safe boxes. It was just common, and that was my first exposure to those things. I believe it's age 7. Is that the
average age?
Yes.
Is 10.
Okay, average age is 10.
But it's going down.
Yeah, that's also going down. You can get it as early as 6 and 7 year olds. We're seeing it now too, because of that dependence on technology. So 93% of boys, 62% of girls, and rising. Before age 18, they see that. 71% of teens hide what they do online from their parents, which is easy because we've grown up with technology. We really know how to use it. Those that are older, they immigrated to technology. We're native to technology. So we're very aware of how it works. You've got to learn how it works. And because we know how it works, we can hide those things. and know how to, more than just deleting history, finding ways where, okay, my parents will never see this, and they're not going to ask me about it, so I don't have to tell them about it, and we can just do this and keep it hidden.
Can I interject?
Yes, please do.
For those of you who are parents here today, if you don't know that there are apps that your teens can download where they can hide secret files from you, I would highly suggest that you Google that. There are several of them out there. One of them looks like a calculator. You wouldn't know it by anything else. It looks exactly like a calculator. It functions like a calculator, but it is actually an app used to hide secret files on your phone from people. Most likely, teens use it to hide stuff from their parents.
Yeah.
So if you don't know about that, surprise, it exists. Do your research. Know what your kids are looking at.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that as well in the other session. 64% of Christian men view porn once a month. That number's also going up. 37% watch it several times a week. And the important part about the 64% of once a month, that is the national average. That's non-Christians. So there is no distinction in percentage between the Christian and the non-Christian as far as men are concerned.
You'd think it would matter.
Yeah, you'd think that would change things. One group knowing who Jesus is, but the percentage is the same and going up. That indicates a lot of what the problem is with this particular sin. 56% of divorce cases involve one party having obsessive interest in porn sites. That is a large part of why people break up the marriage or relationships or other things. You're seeing now... I'm going off script now.
Go for it.
Excellent. You're seeing now in some of the Viagra commercials are similar to that. There are younger men in those commercials. Why is that? Because porn has made it to where you can't have sex anymore normally. Because it's not enough. Because now you've trained your brain to need more with the dopamine and all these other things we'll be talking about. That is only going to continue to get worse. Talking about technology earlier and how there are people already talking about 5G and working on 5G for your phones and speeds. And we're going to get to the point where if you think it, it can happen almost instantaneously. And that's what they're working on next. That has some incredible applications. And I'm wondering how people are going to use that for pornography, because they are. We have virtual reality pornography already. We have robots that we're working on for that in places. It's going to happen. And so this the real thing is not going to be enough. It's already starting that way, and it's going to continue that way. 1 in 5 cell phone searches are for pornography. You think about how many times you Google something, just you personally. 1 in 5, just globally, it's for pornography. 63% of men looked at porn at work in the last 3 months, and almost 40% have done so more than once. While they're at work, hey, I'm just going to turn it on. And for a lot of people that are entrenched in it for a while, they're looking at it at work, not because it's I want to see if I can get away with it, that sort of thing. It's your brain is telling you, you're at a computer, why not now? And go look at it, and it starts to become this very heavy dependency. 64% of men in college spend time online every week for internet sex, and 18% of women in college do this as well. We have those underlined. I'm not sure why.
In case there's college students here, I don't know.
Okay. Any college students here? Perfect. Ignore that statistic. 55% of married men.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. 55% of married men watch porn at least once a month. And that's just a general statistic. But here's the last one I want us to pay attention to. 51% of ministers say that it's a real temptation. You factor that in with all of the other statistics about men who are... keep this in mind with the statistics, by the way. These are men who said, yes, I go and look. How many are not admitting to doing that? That number becomes a lot higher. The 51% of ministers say porn is a real temptation. Why do you think that is? That's for you. Feel free to throw something out. Why do you think ministers would say that this is a real temptation for them?
Just going on with that is stress.
Yeah, the stress that's behind it. And what we'll see as we continue on, I didn't see any other hands. That's good, because that's why we're talking about this. So that's helpful. And what we're going to see with pornography, especially as we get into the second session, is that the problem is very rarely pornography in and of itself. That it is an attempted solution, a very bad one, to a problem that already exists in your life. And so you turn to it to escape or to deal, all the while this real issue goes untouched and is going to just continue to facilitate. And now you have a new problem on top of the problem that you already had before. Those are the statistics. I know we ran through several of those things there, but it is a real problem. If you think that, well, my congregation's different, my church is different, it's not. And I know that's a generalization. It's not. You have people that are sitting in the pew, in the chair, every week that are dealing with this. We've had people talk to us just this weekend about situations they're dealing with right now that they never would have guessed would have been an issue, but they were, and it was far worse than they ever could have imagined it being a problem. You're dealing with that every week. The people you sit by are watching this, and they don't want to, but they don't know how to quit. Here's why. We're going to talk about the more in depth what this does to your brain when you're watching this. And we'll talk about the cycle of addiction as well with all this.
Let's talk about drugs, as if porn wasn't enough.
Yeah, throw it on.
But before I do, let me say this, that like Jack said, the problem with pornography is rarely porn in and of itself, and it's rarely has anything to do about sex. It's typically someone trying to cope with or cover up some pain in their life that they experienced. And we need to be clear on that, because especially with this issue, but also in the church as a whole, sex can become the enemy, right? And I have listened to couples that have reached out to me before where they were taught growing up that sex is bad. And so as they get into their marriage, they are believing this. Okay, sex is bad. Now I'm in a marriage relationship where, you know, we're allowed to have sex, but I still feel bad about it. I still feel dirty, even though we're married and we do these things. And that's one thing we need to clear up in our churches, that sex is not bad. Sex is a gift that God has given us. And in the context of a marriage, sex is a beautiful thing, right? And when we look at, from the very beginning, Genesis 2, when Adam and Eve are brought together and said that they need to hold fast to each other and they become one flesh, we need to understand that that is not just talking about the sexual relationship there either. But when, and if you're in a marriage relationship, you know this, that it's not just physical, it's spiritual, it's emotional, and it's also, as we're going to talk about here, it's also chemical. Things that bind you together. So when these drugs that we produce in our brains naturally, they happen during sex, but also, more importantly, when someone looks at pornography. And first and foremost, number one culprit in this whole thing is dopamine, as we discussed earlier. Dopamine is the drug in our brain. It's the reward centers. It says, oh, that pizza tasted amazing, you should have another slice. Okay? I love pizza. I've yet to have a bad pizza. You put bread and sauce and cheese and meat together, I don't see how you could go wrong.
Perfect.
Okay?
Perfect.
Anyways, while I get sidetracked on pizza. Dopamine, when someone watches pornography and they see something they like, that dopamine is released in the brain, and it says, ooh, that was good, I should do that again. Now, again, context of a marriage relationship, that's great and that's beautiful. You should have sex again. You should have more than just one time. But when you're watching pornography, it becomes a problem, right? And the other problem with dopamine is that it craves novelty. And what I mean by that is that enough is never enough. You wonder why, and I've been talking to several people, and in fact, the speaker that's on next is going to talk about abuse. And what I said to him yesterday was that nobody wakes up and says, you know what sounds good today, is I want to be a pedophile today. Nobody does that. It's a progression. It's this constant activity of walking through doors that you know you shouldn't walk through, and then once you've done that, that's not good enough anymore. I need to find another barrier or door to walk through, and you start chasing the dopamine, and that's why you hear these stories in the news, and you go, that's crazy, right? How could anyone ever get involved in this or that? And it's because it wasn't a one-day thing. It was a cycle. It was a progression. And that's what chasing the dopamine looks like. Another one, I should say this before we move on, that the amount of high that you get from watching pornography is about, they say that you feel about 11 times better. So you get a huge rush of dopamine in your brain, and that is part of the addiction side of it, that if you know in your head, oh, I can feel 11 times better than I'm feeling right now, that's a huge temptation for people, and sometimes it's too big of a temptation. Drug number two is testosterone. Typically, again, found in us males, right? We produce a lot of testosterone. Testosterone is, what makes us grow hair and makes us, big and burly for some of us. For some of us. It's okay. Granted, I can't grow a beard, so
that's, I got you on that.
but testosterone also controls our sex drive. That is the reason why guys, at 11 o'clock at night when, it seems like, all right, it's time for bed, we can roll over and say, what do you think? And the wife's like, what do I think?
It's 11 o'clock.
It's time to go to bed. But it's what controls our sex drive. And the problem, again, when we look at pornography, if we get a boost of testosterone when we're looking at it, it just perpetuates the cycle, right? That you watch pornography, you get more testosterone, which makes you want to watch more and have sexual interaction more, and it just starts the cycle. Number three is norepinephrine. Norepinephrine, that is adrenaline. That's what we get a spike of this when danger's nearby or when someone swerves over into your lane. You feel that spike. That's like, whoa, okay, it wakes you up, right? The problem that they're finding as far as it being connected to pornography is that they're finding that events in your life that you experience when you have norepinephrine pumping through your veins, you tend to remember a lot better. You tend to have a more vivid memory of the things that you see and experience while you have adrenaline pumping through your veins. And this is, again, a problem that if you really want to forget the things that you saw, you can't, like, our brain doesn't work that way, right? It doesn't work like a computer where you can just take the file and throw it into the trash can. I wish it did. I really do. Because I would erase so much stuff out of my head, but it doesn't work that way. Not only do our brains not work that way, but when you have this norepinephrine, it's so vivid and so clear in our brains for so long that where can you go? And this is, I told someone else this, that where can you go to run away from your own brain, right? That a drug addict could never meet his drug dealer again, or an alcoholic could make the decision to never step into a bar again. Where does the porn addict go to run away from his own brain? Two other drugs real quick. Is oxytocin. This is the cuddle drug. It's the love drug, what people call it. And this is also released into our brains when we watch pornography. And so it sounds weird, but the porn addict, as they're watching these videos and images, they actually can form a bond and start to fall in love with these things that they're watching. The last one is serotonin. Serotonin is it causes a like an elevated mood. That's like, like in the old 90s sitcoms and stuff, after someone had sex, it was always like, oh, I'm happy and fun to be around now. I'm not cranky anymore. And that's because of the serotonin, right? It gives you an elevated mood. And the problem with that, again, is that if you start chasing that, if you start saying to yourself, I don't feel normal unless I have this certain level of serotonin in my brain, in my body, then I'm not normal, and you're going to chase that and watch pornography in order to get it.
And that's, again, why the real thing isn't good enough anymore, because everything becomes elevated, and the real thing can't replicate the fantasy that is at your fingertips, available because of the technology and our own impatience and the accessibility to it all. We want to, very quick, because we've got about 10 minutes, talk about the cycle of addiction, how this works, and why it continues to be a cycle instead of breaking off one way. And in session two, we'll talk about how you shatter that cycle and bust it wide open. It starts with fantasy, thinking about what do I want? What do I want to get away from? What do I want to run to? And one of the popular pornography websites posts every year their most popular categories that are searched, because the business is, we'll provide whatever type of thing you're looking for. And so if you can think it up, it's probably there in porn form somewhere. And so you can have whatever fantasy you want. Don't have to imagine it. It's there. You can watch it. It's available to you. This leads to the ritual part of the cycle. I'm going to set the stage. This is the, I need to close the shutters, lock the doors. What time is it? And when do my parents get home from work? You know, finding that the opportune time, planning everything out so that you don't get caught. And that's a big trouble of all this. I said, you're fooling yourself if you think the people in your pews are not struggling with this. And when I say struggling, I mean struggling. Because they know they don't want to do it anymore. But they don't know how to get out of it. You go through all the trouble of setting the stage, and the whole time you're thinking about, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I also do want to do this. I do want to do this. And there's this very heavy internal struggle about what to do. But you go and set the stage after you have the fantasy. You act out to it. Mentioned masturbation earlier. However it is you're going to act out to what you're watching, and that's where you get all this release of testosterone, dopamine, serotonin, all those things we just talked about. That's where all that's built, and then you hit the crash of despair. Realizing once the chemicals go away and you sit back and look, why did I do it again? And that happens every time. The problem is, you know, why doesn't it break off here to, I need to repent, I need to stop? Because you've already given the brain exactly what it wants, and it will tell you later, when you stop thinking about how could I do that again, the brain says, remember how good that felt? And now you're back in it all over again. And so how do we break that cycle? We'll talk about that in the second session.
Back after lunch.
But that's how the cycle plays out, and that is in the mind of the people that you're sitting next to. One of the, in talking about this perfect storm, the accessibility we have, the advancement of technology, how that's going to continue to increase, our dependency on technology, that's going to continue to increase. You don't have to go to the seedy dark alley to go get this stuff. It's there. And it's becoming commonplace. You'd be surprised at how often women in forums say, how much is normal for my husband to be looking at? I know it's fine, just how much is normal? It's becoming accepted now in all types of relationships, as this is just how it works. And all that continuing to increase, cultural acceptance, along with all these other things, gives us this perfect storm. I knew exactly what I was going to say before I started saying all that, and then it went.
No, it sounded good.
Thank you. Thank you. There's a conclusion to all of this. The process with this of how do we deal with that, that's what I was going to say. The way we have been dealing with it, don't talk about it. That's number one. What happens when you don't talk about a sin, when you hide it? We talked about teens hiding their online behavior. What happens when you leave those things alone? It doesn't make it go away. It causes it to spread. Thing number two, when we do talk about it, I sat in a preacher luncheon, not here, years ago. If I can say years ago, it was a few years ago. Sitting in a preacher luncheon, talking about how he would deal with the problem. And he said, those perverts just need to stop. And that's his solution to the problem. And then we wonder, with phrases like that, when we do talk about it, or when we do talk about it, well, if they would just pray more and read their Bible more, they're reading their Bible. They're praying. They're saying, God, take it away. I know that it's wrong. I want to stop. And then it keeps going. They're doing all of that. When we do talk about it, it just makes people want to hide even more, because they don't feel like, I can come out and talk about this because I'm going to be destroyed. I'm going to be ostracized. I'm going to be lose my job. People are going to think horribly of me in the church. I can't go forward and talk about this. I'll get it handled myself. That doesn't work. We're two examples of that does not work. You have to have other people involved in your life. We'll talk about the right way to handle all of this stuff after lunch. I think that was planned because it's an exciting topic, I guess, for after lunch. That's why we have the break. But after lunch, we're going to deal with specifically the whole time solutions. How do you break the brain chemistry? Not an easy process. If you ever talk to somebody who's caught up in the nicotine addiction with smoking or with drinking, how do you break that cycle? It is possible, but it is painstaking what has to take place in order for that to be broken apart. And the longer that that's gone on, the more cemented all of this is in their mind. The other part of this, too, is in the process of breaking it, you can't be surprised when, they went back to it. That's going to happen. You have to expect that to happen. If you're dealing with it or helping somebody through it, patience is very necessary. And we'll talk more in depth about all of those things at the end. You have anything more to add?
I'll just say one thing real quick. For our second session, we're going to try to get through it in enough time that we're going to allow a question and answer, because I know at least everywhere that I've been, people have questions about what we present. And so if you have questions, please bring them to the second session. If you can't make the second session, I realize there's some great classes being offered here this weekend. And if you can't make it to the second session, please get with Jack or I, and we can get you the information, because this is what we're about. We want to be able to help. So go to the website, get with Jack or I, and we can give you our contact information. The last thing I want to say before we close, I got like 2 minutes. I want to speak to the people that are in here today, because again, the statistics tell us that even though we might not like to admit it, there are people in this room right now who are struggling. And you might be asking yourself, after we listed all of those things, right? The perfect storm of technology and impatience, all the drugs, the cycle of addiction, it gets kind of clinical in how we speak about it. And so let me make it real for us real quick. If you're asking yourself, am I addicted? You know, that's a big word, right? I might have a problem, but am I really addicted? There's two key signs to addiction, and that is, one is obsessing, like Jack was talking about, with the fantasizing. It's, how can I do this, or how can I get away with it? Are you waiting for your wife to leave the house to go shopping so you can finally, watch some pornography? Or are you thinking, the work computer doesn't have any filtering on it? That's obsession. That's an unhealthy amount of thinking going towards something you know you shouldn't be doing. And then the second part is continuing, knowing that there are going to be negative consequences and yet doing it anyways. If you have obsession and you're continuing in the action, I would say you meet the requirements for addiction. Again, if you need help yourself, if you are struggling, if you know someone who is, if you have a spouse, a husband, or a wife who is struggling, reach out. Because the more that we are willing to talk about it, and the more that we are able to name this in our churches, the better off we will be. That is all we got. Thank you for your attention. And we'll see you back after lunch if you're here.